Hey everybody, welcome back to another Bald Move Prestige film. This time we are taking a look at the 1982 legal thriller, The Verdict. It stars Paul Newman, as well as Charlotte Rampling, Jack Warden, James Mason, Milo O'Shea. I gotta say that I don't know much about these folks. Usually I try to like, oh, you'll know them from such roles as, but I got nothing. I got nothing for most of these people, except for Paul Newman. Everybody knows Paul
obviously.
Newman.
There are two people in here that you might know if you're a 90s, 80s to 90s movie fan. You might also know the Jack Warden, who plays his like friend who's trying to kick his life back into gear over the course of this movie. He was the grandpa in Problem Child. He was also the grandpa, I think, or no, he is Pops, which I think was one of their dads in Dirty Work. He was in Toys, that weird Robin Williams movie.
So a lot of films that I'm not familiar with, except for Robin Williams and Toys. But I've only seen that movie like once.
And he did a bunch of stuff earlier than this movie too.
Oh like, yeah,
people
these guys
probably
are very,
know him from those.
I think there are a lot of English and Irish actors too, which might explain why like a lot of the names were ringing a bell, because they're playing, you know, takes place supposedly in Boston. It's all filmed in New York, but it's a time of Boston where there's still, you can hear a lot of Irish lilt in the air in these communities.
Oh, yeah.
But it was directed by Sidney Lumet, which I have heard of, and he has directed a lot. These are just the Oscar nominees. 12 Angry Men for Best Picture, Dog Day Afternoon, Network. He's a pretty big, old school film screenplay written by David Mamet, who is fairly famous for writing Glengarry Glenn Ross. He kind of, in my mind, he's more like a Aaron Sorkin, in that he's like a dialogue specialist, but he's much more brutalist in his approach. It's much more, you know, instead of witty and fast paced, it's more like savage and biting in the dialect. But he's written a lot of stuff. The Postman Rings, Always Rings Twice, The Untouchables. I like that movie a lot. Hoffa, Wag the Dog, Hannibal, I think is his most recent, based on a novel by the same name, The Verdict by Barry Reed. The first time I saw this movie, I think went on a Newman kick. I don't know what caused it. Maybe it was that damn pool movie.
Got the Hustler, yeah. Kick. I didn't realize you had seen this before. Okay. Did we watch it together?
We watched it together. We were like kind of trading back and forth like movies neither of us had seen or whatever. And you're like, have you ever seen The Verdict? And I'm like, no. And or maybe it's because we were watching some other legal thing. But anyway, you said The Verdict and I'm like, okay, let's watch it. And I remember really, really liking it and thinking it like, yeah, this is a great legal thriller. I watched it again today and I still appreciate it. But like, it's funny. We just talked about Amadeus, which is widely recognized as one of the greatest films ever made. This is widely recognized as one of the greatest legal thrillers ever made. And you said, you know, you're like, you know, with the Amadeus, like, I don't exactly know why. Like, I understand why this is a good film and why this is an entertaining film and why it's a great watch. It's very watchable. I'm not sure why it's a great film. And I tried to pay attention because when I was doing my pre-research, I saw David Mamet. I'm going to definitely pay attention to the dialogue and Sidney Lumet with the 12 Angry Men, the courtroom thriller. Okay, I'm going to be looking for that. And I did see a lot of, like, these flashes of stuff. But, like...
Right.
The courtroom theatrics struck me as kind of like unplausible. Like when the movie got to the results, the verdict, the actual verdict, it shocked me. Like, I don't see how we got here from there. And then the movie just kind of winds up. So maybe I have to see it more times, but like, I guess I'm going to lean on you. Tell me the greatness of this film, Jim. What's your experience with it? Why do you like it so much? Et cetera, et cetera.
I think my feelings on it, my relationship with it have changed after having watched it at least three times. It is a movie that came out in 1982, so it's before a lot of the other courtroom thrillers, you know, except like 12 Angry Men, obviously, like came before this and sort of set the bar. I would say, after having seen this a few times, this movie doesn't quite hit that bar. I think I like 12 Angry Men better. Mm-hmm. for me, this movie is all about the end, and it's everything from the speech he gives in summation of this court case up until the credits roll. That's only like a 2-minute window there, because this movie is very slow in its pacing. It takes a long time to get started. You're watching Paul Newman sort of go about his life, which is very sad. And they're really like setting the stage for this guy has experienced some downward spiral in his life. And when the court case comes in, you know, things hopefully will start to turn around for him. Who knows? But by the end of the movie, it has picked up its pacing a little bit. When it gets to the actual courtroom stuff and you start experiencing like all the things you think about in courtroom dramas, right? Where witnesses are challenged and evidence can't be presented, and people go missing, and there's all sorts of opposition from the defense. That's kind of where this movie picks up and really like grabs me. And then that ending, I think the ending of this movie is fantastic. I think everything from that speech to the end, I won't say too much right now because we're not talking spoilers, but I really feel those moments strongly.
I know. I think you're right. Like his closing statements, all that stuff is incredibly strong. And the cinematography is really amazing too. And what it's suggesting and what it's actually accomplishing, and the fact that it's just this long ass take, a complicated dialogue and motions and the entire, like, you have this huge room with tons of people in the background.
And the way they stage that, when, you know, depending on who he's standing next to and where he wants the jury to look and where he wants the judge to look, things like that.
It's funny because, like, I think one of the problems I have this film is that, like, this is one of those movies that every other movie since bites from.
Yeah.
You know, and like there was a huge cottage industry in the 90s of legal thrillers, like John Grisham single-handedly brought the legal potboiler back into the public. And there's like tons of them just made. And like, I feel like The Rainmaker in particular, which I just saw like 3 months ago on a lark. Is like just a straight up better version of this movie. It's got because one of my problems with this movie is like when I read this, they always frame the Robert Newman character as heroic, right?
Yes, the combination of Robert Redford and Paul Newman.
Sorry,
I understand why you'd make that mistake. They're in basically every movie together.
Yeah. Paul Newman is this heroic figure. But like, I don't know. He sees like a guy, like a mail clerk in World War II that was assigned to deliver a letter a half mile down the road to another station behind enemy lines, and took it upon himself to go to Berlin and try to murder Hitler, and gets in all kinds of trouble, wins 3 Purple Hearts and a Congressional Medal of Honor. But on the other hand, dude, you were just supposed to run the envelope down a half mile. Like, all of this heroic shit is the stuff that you yourself put yourself, you know, you put yourself in this situation and periled a bunch of people and, you know, and then kind of survived by dumb doodah luck. And I feel like, I don't know, there's just the relationship that he has with the woman, there's like, you know, there's a romantic interest in this film that does not work for me at all. Other than we can't talk about the spoilers yet. And the court, like, now I do like, it's funny because like when I watched The Rainmaker, it's clear like how much of the stuff it's cribbing from this movie. And it's just like, oh, well, this didn't work. So, instead of having like a, you know, instead of our hero being kind of washed up, bitter alcoholic, let's make him like literally just out of law school, newly minted. He's an underdog, you know, instead of this kind of a hard bitten woman character but let's give him, you know, like there's all this like stuff that's like kind of an upgrade of this material. The one downgrade is I can't remember who is it. James Mason. Is he the defense attorney?
I think so. That sounds right.
Yeah, because he is just amazing. Like, there, this,
he's
like
such a character. I don't know. I mean, he is a character. Yeah,
but he's not played as weird, because a lot of times these defense attorneys are played as very kind of slimy and sleazy. Where this guy is just a master tactician. He's got contacts in the press. He knows like months ahead of where you're at, what he needs to do into the newspapers and the television interviews and the puff pieces. To like, you know, poison the jury well before you, Like he's doing next level jury tampering. Like, hey, let's just like have a puff piece on how these many lives these doctors save 6 months before the trial, just so that's kind of percolating. And he's kind of like grandfatherly and, you know, genteel and well mannered. He's not wearing like fancy suits. He's kind of like, you know, tweed professor jacket stuff. And he might be one of my favorite evil defense attorneys of all time.
He's great. I could totally see him in a Sorkin. Sorkin kind of role too. I don't know that he could necessarily pull off the quick dialogue, but I don't know, the way he talks is so like unique and mm-hmm. honestly funny to me at times. Uh-huh. Just I don't know. It's I have a hard time looking past the way the actor is doing the thing that the actor is doing to see how good this character is, because I don't know, I get distracted by it. He's good, but, though. Like I'm not going to lie. I really do enjoy the scenes where, you know, he's talking, he's consulting with his legal team, and you know, you see the way they juxtapose the legal team of the defense with the legal team of the two dudes right. in the shitty bar, you know, pouring over the old files that they've had in their desk for 18 months and didn't even look at.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Good stuff there.
Yeah, and that's one of the other funny things is like Newman's constantly referring to his staff. You know, right. My staff's doing that, and he's just like he has nobody.
His staff is Mickey.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. Do you want to get into? I can introduce the movie because I imagine a lot of people haven't seen this.
Yeah,
and then we can talk. We can talk after that. If we can take a break and then talk spoilers.
Sure.
Okay. So this movie, The Verdict, is about a lawyer. Played by Paul Newman, who you get the idea through drips and drabs of the story, was this amazing young attorney. Law school prodigy, courtroom ace, somehow got involved in a jury tampering scandal, got drummed out of his high profile partnership, and has hit the rocks, has been, you know, a decade on of failed cases and falling into the depths of crippling alcoholism. And his old, I think, mentor is his dude. Maybe he went to law school with him, or maybe he was a teacher of his in law school or something like that, is trying to give him lifelines. And he's set him up this plum case. All he's got to do is walk in there. It's ripe for settlement, get a settlement, and then try to rebuild his life. It's the case of a young woman, a mother who went in pregnant to a Catholic hospital to give birth. And through a series of medical accidents and perhaps negligence, end up in a coma that she is never going to recover from. She's in a permanent vegetative state, and her family wants to sue the doctors and hospital involved to get the money to pay for her care. He gets into his head that he is going to refuse to settle, and he's going to expose these doctors and this institution for what they are and the mistakes they've made. And against everyone's wishes, even the families, like he just goes fucking maverick rogue, probably some disbarring offenses he commits in the course of this film. And he just tries. It's him versus everybody. He's taken on the world, the judge, the defense, the well-heeled defense attorneys, the Catholic Church, the idea of medicine in its entirety. He's going to take it down and the half of the film takes place in just courtroom battle. And then you get to the verdict. Is he actually going to win with all these crazy risks, with all his personal foibles, with all the stacks, the deck stacked against him? Is he going to be able to win? That's mm-hmm. the question. And called The Verdict. So it's kind of it could be a surprise. Maybe it's not. So yeah, that's the film.
All right.
Let's take a break and then get back to talking about it.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well. Lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Can I start with one of the most confusing things about this movie for me and maybe
sure.
clear it up a little bit? I am very much not aware of how religious medical institutions work. And so when they start showing this, I don't know. I don't even know what he is. Like, he could be the Pope for all I know. This dude in all these religious get-ups, and he is at the building. You know, that he calls Paul Newman over to talk about the settlement. And I'm like, why is this religious guy mixed up in this medical case? And I see that the building he's going to is the same building that this guy exists in. But also the patient is there. I get very confused. And eventually I had to like try and figure out, okay, this must be a combination like hospital / religious thing. And they keep referring to it at the Archdiocese, which I don't know what any of that means. Do you have any insight to that stuff?
A little bit. I wasn't prepared to discuss. But so a diocese is just essentially a district of the church.
Okay.
You know, like a confederation of churches that all have like either a bishop or a cardinal over. And the archdiocese is kind of like, you know, a collection of those.
Okay.
And I think those are per continent. Like you have maybe there's two in North America, but got like an archdiocese of this, that, and the other. As far as the medical, like I don't know how Catholic hospitals are administered. I imagine that like a lot of hospitals, you have civilian leadership, you know, the people are involved in the maintaining of the building and the contracts and the money. And you've got the medical administration, which are the actual doctors, the practice medicine and all there. And I imagine in a Catholic hospital, you've got like a third leg, which is the church itself, which is bankrolling the operation, you know, or like definitely paid like at some.
They've got their hand in the pie. Is that what you mean? Because like bank, yeah. What do you mean bankrolling? Because medicine bankrolls itself.
It's true. But like, you know, when like there's indigent patients that can't pay, you know, and they're allowed some degree of leeway because every single time there's any kind of reproductive health care law, like in terms of abortion, in terms of what do they call that? Baby preventing stuff. Birth control. When it comes to baby prevention, the Catholic Church tends to like flex its muscles and try to carve out exceptions for their doctors and nurses and what that work in their hospital, because obviously,
of course,
they have religious exceptions and how they view that kind of stuff. But I don't know to what extent they're successful and all that stuff. Yeah, I got, but obviously this guy is kind of like, you know, especially when talking 50 years ago, I think you're supposed to see him as like the hospital administrator.
Yeah,
he's like the money guy.
For sure. And so like eventually I figured out that, okay, he's going to this place, which is a hospital, but also run by the Catholic Church. I was just confused by it.
Yeah. I think that's where there's a little, it's even more salacious because, you know, like if it's the Catholic Church trying to protect its own image and it's charitable work here, it's not just these doctors for money. It's like there's a whole, you know, and then also I understand like in Boston, you know, a Catholic Church is even a bigger deal, especially during this time. There's a lot of stuff that's like of its time in this film, like the reaction to the black expert doctor witness.
Yeah, smoking, you know, in restaurants.
Right. The extreme religiosity that's still shown in these neighborhoods. But yeah, I like how they effortlessly portray, like, sketch Newman's character. You know, like he's the opening shot of him hanging out at a bar playing pinball. Then I've heard of ambulance chasers before. I've never heard of a hearse chaser.
Yeah,
where like that seems like even a lower class, where you're just walking up to widows and being like, "Yeah, it was a shame what happened to your husband. Here's my card,"
and literally sticking it into their hand, and they're non-responsive. It's like, oh god,
right. Like I said, you know, it's like we're talking to living victims that you can like, but like when you're just going to the bereaved, it seemed like it's even. And the movie treats it like he gets thrown out.
Yeah,
he gets bounced from one of these funerals. And, you know, he's got a friend that's trying to help him out, and he's doing that, you know, push this guy away. Like, what are you, my nanny? And the guy's like, well, yeah, you know, I guess somebody should be. You need right. a lot of help.
Yeah, they do. But the way they portray him, I get a sense of his routine, you know, his breakfast, let's call it, where he goes to the bar, he drinks a couple of shots, he plays a bunch of pinball, he drinks apparently a couple of eggs in a couple more glasses, or in another glass of something, beer, I don't know, whiskey.
If he's got court that day, sure.
right. I get the idea that is his idea of breakfast. And he does that basically every morning, which I guess, what is that drink? Is a lazy fizz? It's like, oh, I could make a fizz. I could, you know, aerate the yolks and pour it on, or I could just dump the whole fucking egg in and drink it. And maybe I'll be Rocky. I don't know.
I don't know. They do have a name for that. I've never been that kind of drinker that I'm adding raw eggs and shit to the concoction, you know?
No.
He also is like this guy. So he's destitute, but he does spend like, you know, you show him holding court at this bar late at night and he's buying people rounds, and you kind of get the idea so he can just talk about his glory days, you know, like he doesn't have any friends. He's always on the lookout for a woman, you know, that he can convince is, you know, he's still a hotshot lawyer and he can take her home and try to stave off total collapse into depression and decrepitude one more day. He's just, and the thing I think is interesting about this movie is he never loses that aspect. Like he is white knuckling his alcoholism the entire movie. And you can see his, like, you know, the effects of hangovers and frustration and inebriation, like coloring all the different things that are happening in this film, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah. And you can see that over the course of the movie, there are different things that sort of push him to drinking. At first, it's just his life, right? He just sits around. That's what he does. And then, you know, as the case gets tougher and as obstacles mount, you sort of feel the weight of that pushing him toward it. I think by the end of this movie, he has virtually stopped drinking. Though I couldn't pinpoint when that turn happens because it is pretty gradual.
In fact, I had missed that. Like when we were discussing it before we started recording this podcast, I took a completely different interpretation of that final scene because I thought he was drinking Irish coffee.
oh, okay. Yeah.
To use a racially insensitive to slur against the Irish folks. He's drinking. I thought that that was the, like, that they were telling me that he had saved his client improbably, but he had not saved himself. That he was like, you know, this phone call is going to keep this phone call. Like, I thought I was telling that it kept on going on. He didn't like take the phone off the hook. He didn't hang up. It's like it's a call, and the way he kind of puts his head back, closes his eyes, like eventually he's going to pick up that phone, and it's going to, you know, obviously not literally lead him to destruction, but the cycle will eventually repeat. Nothing has fundamentally changed about his life other than he got a victory. Because I felt like the victory is kind of sort of unearned. This guy's. That's the thing. Like, this guy feels like it was less reliant on his skill as a lawyer and him just kind of like bumbling around, stepping on rake after rake after rake. And eventually one of the rakes snapped
To me, it felt like he was trying to run a marathon and there was this shitty defense attorney in a bow tie throwing rakes in front of him the entire time. And he keeps stepping on him. And then eventually he's able to like sidestep one of those rakes, but then he steps onto another rake that the judge throws in front of him. And then like everybody on the sidelines realizes, oh shit, they just threw a bunch of rakes in his face. Maybe we should just declare him the winner.
Yeah. I mean, there's like a very early on in the courtroom battle when they're talking about that, his expert witness that didn't go so well, he says, you know, the jury every once in a while surprises you with the capacity they have to hear the truth. And I think that's literally what happened.
Yes.
And I find some of that stuff, like, I know I've talked about this in Better Call Saul, but like every time I see a devastating piece of evidence and then objection sustained, blah, blah, blah. And then the judge turns to the jury and is like, look, I want all y'all to fucking Man in Black style mind wipe yourself. You cannot consider this evidence and ruling the guilt or innocence. And I'm always like, do they really? There's no fucking way that can't, like, when you're talking about things like, and I know this is a civil case, so this is more preponderance of evidence. This is more, are you 50-50? Are you 51-49% sure of guilt or innocence? But like when you're talking shadows of doubt, like that's literally what we're talking about, right? Like, and I understand why the court is set up to do that, because honestly, I didn't find the star witness that compelling. Like, it seems the rules of evidence are put in to prevent stuff like that. Oh, this person come flying in 4 years later with a recollection and a photocopy that they... We have the original, but the photocopy, they say, like, that seems like that's pretty shitty evidence just by the rules of, you know, like, we know that this lady is trustworthy and has the, because the movie's letting us know that. It's got an, you know, like an initiate narrator, and the doctors are the real assholes and all that kind of stuff. But like, I don't know. And that's kind of why but that's the thing. It's like, this movie so stacks the deck. I couldn't believe it. I forgot that the judge himself comes in during cross-examination, or I go no direct examination, and like starts hectoring the witness from his fucking judge booth. Like,
yeah,
wild, crazy. Like, this
beyond the pale.
That's like automatic mistrial, right?
Newman threatens it. Yeah, immediately after that.
So is the idea that this guy's playing with house money from that point? Like, he, like, even if he loses, it's going to be a mistrial and they'll be able to try the case again.
It could be. That's certainly what I thought when he, you know, left the judge's chambers after that confrontation. I was thinking, okay, well, at any time he could pull this card, you know, admit the transcript and to, you know, send that to the board, whatever, and get this thing thrown out or tried over again. I feel like this movie, where this movie shines is maybe, you know, not in the details and like in exactly what should and should not be considered evidence, because I mean, like you said, everything is stacked against him, including the biases of the judge, very clear biases. To me, the thing that really makes this movie, the heart of this movie, is the speech that he gives at the end, the summation speech, where he just says, you know, there's a depiction of his life in that speech. There's a summation of his entire career and his entire life after this jury tampering charge that he got, mm-hmm. where that he's pouring into this speech and he's saying, we are so often looking at the law and saying, this feels unjust. Everything about this system, everything about those, you know, technicalities that throw out a document that's, you know, in the testimony of a witness who makes a case and gets justice for somebody is thrown out. All of that shit, it feels like baggage, and you can't do anything about it because the people who are propping up that system want it to be that way, and they are more powerful than you. They have the ability to stack the deck. And in this scenario now, as he's talking to the jury, he's saying, we have the opportunity. And I think he's very much, he's saying you have the opportunity, but I think he's saying, this is also my opportunity. You know, this is the reason I took this case, the reason I refused to settle, because this is my opportunity to finally experience a little bit of justice. And you can do that as the jury. You have the power right now in this moment.
Jury nullification. Yeah.
Yeah. And that to me is the heart of it. Like when you start to just like truly understand this guy's perspective through his entire life in those final moments of the movie. And that's why I like it so much.
I thought, so did they ever, and maybe you know this because you've seen it more than me, but did they ever explain why he got railroaded on these jury tampering charges? Like what instigated that? Like, like it sounded like someone had it out against him, and I also didn't know the names well enough that like they might have been talking about the judge, like this is like an old standing legal grudge or something. But
yeah, I don't know.
You understand that they're trumped up charges, or he was framed for this, but they just state that like it's always like I think it's by the time the movie directly addresses it, you're hearing it like secondhand from his best friend / advisor. He's talking to his girlfriend about it, and he just kind of like it just didn't make sense. Like, why would this guy get ran out?
Well, and the fact that he doesn't actually get disbarred tells me that the charges probably were false,
right? Yeah,
like or he had an immense amount of sway, being, you know, a hotshot lawyer, right?
But he could have. He might, like, they set him up as he's like this rising star, and you know, he had a lot of obviously he probably had a lot of friends.
But right there, that's the injustice, right? The system screwed him there. He's been living with that ever since, and it's been destroying his life. He's spiraled downward. His wife left him. He got kicked out of the firm. He went to jail for a while on these charges. Yeah, and you can feel that, like, he's been searching, or he's been jaded, right? He's been making himself the victim, like he says in that speech, this entire time since then. And now mm-hmm. he's finally trying to dig himself out of that, and the jury here has the opportunity to do that on a legal playing field, I guess.
Yeah, it's definitely, I feel like, the loose connection, because when he's I think, just going through the motions. He's taking Polaroids of this young woman who's in a vegetative state in this hospital ward. And as the Polaroids are developing, he gets this like look on his face. It's like the scene like takes 2 minutes long. Like you're literally watching photos develop, and you're watching Paul Newman flop sweat about this internal roil that's going on inside of him. And he walks out and decides he's not going to take this settlement. And you think it's because it's because he's angry about the injustice to the woman, but he even directly states, if I take this money, I'm lost, which I feel like that weakens the central premise of the movie, that he's like, you know, trying to get justice for this girl. Like, I think it's pretty, like, I think you're actually laying it out that it's pretty naked on the face reading that he doesn't care so much about getting justice for this family and the girl, is that like, this is him litigating his entire life.
For like, sure.
This thing that happened to her was unjust, and she got steamrolled by more powerful people who are covering up for their tracks and doing all this, and she get ground up, and so did I. And by God, if I can get, you know, a lot of money for this family, then, you know,
yeah,
but it's such a incredible risk. Like, I thought, like, mm-hmm. It was hard for me not to turn against Paul Newman when the brother-in-law confronts him and is like, what the fuck, man? We could have got $210,000 and been done with this thing. You know, what are you doing? He's got this speech about, you know, people like you do these things and make these decisions, and people like us, and he's talking about his wife and him, the little people are left to pay the butcher's bill for it. Which I thought would then have some impact on because Newman could realize, oh, I'm the big wig to this guy that's grinding him up in my... But like, I don't feel like that ever... Maybe he's still too much of an alcoholic, but I don't feel like that ever changed his viewpoint on the case or anything, or like...
No, I don't.
Dedicated him to it, or...
No, it didn't change it. But at that moment in the movie, you're supposed to be thinking exactly that, right? Like, oh, yeah, no, this could actually be ruinous to this family. It could be ruinous to him if this doesn't succeed. And they have these competing pressures, too, because his wife, the sister of the victim here, does not want to settle, I don't believe. I think she actually wants justice, but they don't dwell on that a ton.
Aww.
They have, once this husband steps in, he's kind of front and center and putting the pressure on Newman to settle. But I think there are scenes in this movie that show that she does not want to settle. She wants justice, but she's unwilling to speak up over her husband who wants to get this money. You know, he's talking about like, I'm the working man. You know, I work hard to do all this and then you just piss it away, whatever. That's his perspective. I think hers is very different. And that's what, that's the tension here, right? Is like, is he going to risk everything, both his own reputation and life, in order to maybe, against all odds, win a case, and the entire time be shit on by the client until hopefully he's proven right? Or man, if he's proven wrong here, if he loses this case, holy shit, he's just not only destroyed himself, but them too.
Yeah, he's flushed the whole lives down the toilet along with his. That's where it's like, that's
important. Or if he does the other thing, if he doesn't pursue this case, is the wife going to be pissed off, right? The sister of the victim, is she going to be feeling like this justice hasn't been done, lose faith in the system, lose, you know, make herself the victim the rest of her life? Like there's, I really find those competing pressures interesting in this movie.
Huh. Yeah, it's interesting because like I was comparing this movie unfavorably to The Rainmaker, and I think that the way that The Rainmaker neatly sidesteps that is they have the lawyer essentially get the family on board with the legal strategy. Like, yes, this is a settlement. Yes, it's considered generous, and you can take it right now, and it will allow you to provide for this, that, and the other. But these people are fucking whores, and they need to be taken down, and the whole family gets on board with it. But whereas this, it's like he's kind of like takes it upon himself, and it's just like it's just all fraught morally. And then, you know, like they're talking about this big time defense attorney and he's doing shit that should get him disbarred. Like it's got to be some kind of form of barratry, some kind of legal mispractice to hire someone to seduce the plaintiff's attorney and give you inside information about.
Mickey discovers it, he's like, oh, you got your mistrial. You know,
right. But of course, fucking Newman doesn't want that. He wants to get him by the throat. But then the very next scene, Newman is busting into some school teacher's mailbox, stealing her phone records.
Yeah.
So that he can. So it's like, because there's some of that in Rainmaker too, but it's always in response to the other person's dirty deeds and it affects the other. It only affects. And maybe that's Grisham just learning from this. Like, okay, what are the. If I'm watching this with modern eyes. What are the moral pitfalls? Where are the places where, as an attorney, I'm like, oh, that's not advocacy for your client. And I like doing those, making tweaks and stuff. And this is just like the alpha version that's the thing of the risk of seeing these movies are hugely influential. If you've seen all the things that influence them is it feels like a paler, less exciting, refined version of what you've already seen.
Sure.
And I will say that about this because I think the performances alone elevate this and like the camera work, which is.
Yeah.
Not flashy, but it does things like in that final one-er, this is like a 1 minute legal take. The camera starts off, as far as I can tell, like three blocks outside of the courthouse shooting into a window because the courtroom is enormous. All these You see the marble statues, you see the wood paneling, the flags, all these people, and Newman looks very small. And throughout his whole speech, it keeps on pushing in and pushing in and pushing in. And then Newman gets to the play. He gets up and starts animated and talking about these very things. Like, what is the justice? What is the court? Is it the wood paneling? Is it the marble statues? Is it this? Or is it like our human concepts of justice? And where do those go? Like, and as he's saying this, like the camera is now pushed into where only Newman is, like just his head filling the frame. And it's doing such a great, like underpinning the script. Like you're going from this one man who's against this vast system, impressive system, to bring it down to just a human level. Like, do you trust me? Do you trust my witness that all she wanted to be was a nurse, and these assholes ran her out of town, threatened her job and all that kind of stuff, ruined her career? Or do you believe these, you know, shyster attorneys and doctors? And I thought that was really cool. And it's something that, like, and especially like I noticed it all towards the end of the scene. And then I realized, oh shit, this has just been one take. And I guess, Newman did this, and this, there's no trick photography at all. He delivers this like 5 minute soliloquy with a bunch of camera moves and stuff all off the cuff.
Yeah, some of those old school actors, man, really good at that stuff.
Well, I guess this is something that they also don't do anymore, which is the director had them do 3 weeks of rehearsal as if it was a stage play.
Yeah.
Before they even maybe some people still do that, but like you can do a lot of polished things because what's a fucking stage play except for a 3 hour one-er, you know, with maybe an intermission. But like you can do that, but it takes a lot of practice and a lot of precision, a lot of discipline. And I don't feel like the kinetic pace of films today kind of lend itself to that.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
Let's play a little podcast volleyball here. I'm going to bump so that you can set me up for the spike. Okay. Talk about the cameo that you told me about in this movie.
So as I talked about the camera pushing in on Paul Newman, you might notice that sitting between the brother-in-law and sister of the victim, very prominently, is a very young Bruce Willey.
Wow. You showed me this photo. I'm like, that is remarkable because he would have been a big star by this point, right? 82? That's got to be around the time that Die Hard came out. No. No, I was totally wrong.
If you're talking about this being filmed in 81, he was still about 4 years away from Moonlighting, 7-8 years away from Die Hard. This was like a very, but this thing is, he doesn't look really young.
Has Bruce Willis ever looked young?
I don't know. I would love to see like a high school photo of him because he might have just come out looking like 35. Some people kind of do that.
So that was the thing. Like I misremembered how early Die Hard happened. And then you were like, oh, yeah, no, it happened much later. It was 88. And that's why it looks so good. It looks more like a 90s film almost. And when I watch this movie, I get the sense that this is a movie of an era, right? This is like slightly modernized Godfather. This is like the conversation era with Gene Hackman. Yep. It has that feel to it. And there are specific shots in this movie that make me think that. One of them is...
I know exactly the ones you're talking about.
The one where Mickey goes to New York before Paul Newman is going to meet with Laura and tells him outside of the bar that they're going to meet in that she's a spy. Mm-hmm. And we haven't really talked about her yet, but I assume we will. That shot is shot from above, and it's shot down on them while they're on the street, and there's no audio except for the street noise. So you can't hear what they're saying, but you can see their physical reactions from a distance. That feels like the conversation where you're spying over the plaza, right?
Yeah, those long telephoto lens shots of them, I thought the exact same damn thing. Like, this feels like we're watching What's-Her-Face and dudes fucking around in the plaza, you know?
Right, right. And if you had the secret mics on them, you'd be able to hear that conversation, but we don't. And then you've got other shots, like when they go to visit, or when Frank goes to the hospital to see, what's the doctor who is going to testify that, you know, yeah, this is the give a deposition.
Like, it's like, yeah, these guys are assholes and I'm going to torch him, his star witness, that then just
fucks off to the Caribbean. Forgets about it. I don't know.
No. That was definitely the defense attorneys and the Catholic Church's work.
Send him on a vacation. Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense. But the shot where he's walking through the building, talking to him, it's all shot from outside the windows, looking in through, you know, you got the darkened outside and the well-lit interior, and you're kind of following them down the stairs as they go. I really liked all those shots, and it feels like an
very
era.
Voyeuristic.
A specific era, because you can do that stuff nowadays, but it's done a little differently.
Usually that's what I was about to say is like, this is a little bit of style without a purpose, because like, I wasn't sure what they were trying to suggest with this voyeuristic. I mean, the conversation, obvious.
Yeah. Of course.
You know, or like usually when you see these techniques in modern films, it's supposed to suggest a usually nefarious third party listening in.
Well, I think it is, you know? Right. It's the defense attorney's team. Keeping tabs on him is what I read from it.
Because they've got the spy. Okay. Right.
Yeah, the whole time he's being spied on, not just by Laura, but by the whole team, right? They probably have six people just following him around.
Completely forgot the plot about her being the double agent. And it was a bomb when I realized. I think I realized Same before here. They actually revealed it, because they mentioned how good is it, because this defense attorney is making these very definitive statements about like, oh, this is happening, and he's going to do this and that. And I think the cardinal remarks about how good is your intelligence? He's like, it's very good. And I'm like, fuck, that's right. She's like spying on them because she's in some kind of like, you get the feeling that she is where Paul Newman was 15 years ago. She's run afoul of some powerful individual and she's fucked up somehow legally and they're trying to ruin her career.
Yeah, it's
and
with
this
her
is her way to get
ex,
back into it.
Right? There's something, they leave it kind of nebulous, but there's Very something with her ex because he was a lawyer. He probably worked at the firm and when they broke up, he probably, I don't know, got her thrown out.
Another basic injustice.
Right.
But that's the thing. It's like, so like every single time I want to get on, like I thought the movie was zigging me on the feeling for Paul Newman, they immediately pulled the rug out from underneath it. Like, I'm like, oh, he's actually getting moved by this young woman's plight and he wants to get justice. Oh no, this is still about him. Oh God, this is such a brutal betrayal. Like, man, he doesn't deserve this. And he just goes and punches her. Full on, like, punches her like a man in a bar, and she's like, no, I deserve that.
I mean, A, she did deserve it, but B, my eyes bugged out of my head when that happened. Holy shit.
Yeah, like, people deserve shit to get punched all the time. Number one, should you ever punch a person? Number two, should you ever punch a person that much weaker than you? Surely not.
Oh, yeah, good points. But
yeah, the movie does that and just... Yeah, no, she was being a parent, but also, did she deserve the fucking pressure that she was feeling that got let her into that? And which, that's right. The other thing, is like, you get the idea that, like, this is causing her to spiral in exactly the same way, yes, Newman did.
And I love that. So that's why I like that ending so much with the phone call, yeah, because she's
fucking bleak,
laying in her hotel bed with a bottle of booze beside her, just totally disheveled, right? Where the state you see Paul Newman in at the beginning of the movie, she's now dropped, yeah, to there, and she's, yeah, calling him, trying to, I don't know. There's some bit of sadness to the end of this for her story, because
for sure,
it's she a bummer is ending. Trying to do something here, right? She's calling him for a reason. I don't think it's to continue spying on him. It's probably to apologize. It's probably to see if she can make amends somehow. Would she actually follow through with that? I don't know. But you get the impression that, like, him not answering the phone is good for him, but bad for her. It might be what he needs at the time. It might be exactly what she doesn't need, but man, how can you fault him for it? It's, yeah, there's a tinge of sadness to the end of that, especially for the Laura character.
Yeah, again, like, my interpretation was wildly different from that. I think you're right, because I just misunderstood the final scene.
Yeah, I mean, if you think he's sitting there with a coffee full of Jack, then yeah, it's a little different.
Yeah,
but
yeah, I thought I even saw him pour something into it. No. Gosh, it's one of those things, like Berenstain things, where like I thought, sure, I saw him putting something, but like, he's doing shit, like, he's Newman's got a lot of stuff, and I guess this was something I learned in my researching, but like, a lot of this stuff was him suggesting. Like, I don't know whether Newman spent a lot of time as an alcoholic or has some friends, but like, him constantly like putting stuff in his mouth to hide his breath that's got a reek of alcohol when he's talking to a client, him squirting red eye reliever drops into his eyes to try to, like, you know, sober himself up and look presentable.
Yeah.
He's doing a lot of that stuff throughout the movie. This is like little things, in his performance, like the way he's slightly more Irish when he's drinking.
Yeah. Let's talk about that. Cause I found some of the Irish accents in here to be very bad. Some of them are good. Some of them are just god awful. It struck me as, like, Paul Newman is the only person in this movie not doing an Irish accent. And when I see all these bad Irish accents around him, I'm like, that is such a shame, because he's the guy who does the best Irish accent in Road to Perdition. So, like,
yeah,
I feel like you're wasting the talent of the fake Irish accent here. Let's get on board with it.
I wonder, because a lot of those guys I think that you're saying have bad fake Irish accents are actually Irishmen, but they're trying to sound like Bostonians.
Well, there's also, I think Laura is French, probably, right, because I hear a tinge of French in her accent, and it's, yeah, everybody threw me off in this movie.
The Irish accent in Boston, even from, like, is drifted. Yeah. Just like I hear that the Quebeci speak French with, like, what Frenchmen call like a hick accent, like okay, a rural, like, sure, it's a rural accent. So like, it'd be hilarious if, like, the actual Irishmen are the least Irish sounding because they're trying to do some kind of bastardized Bostonian Irish accent.
I thought the worst
some
one,
Paddy's Bar kind of accent.
Right. I thought the worst accent, and probably this is what kicked off this whole thing for me and made me think, oh, there's some bad accents in here. It's the sister of the victim, whose name I don't know. She tries to do an accent early on in this movie when she meets for the first time with Newman. And I'm like, oh, no. Oh, they should have just had you be, you know, fifth generation, fully, like, American accent, because, my God, you're trying to do a Boston accent that is not good.
Right, right. Yeah, she's coming a little bit like Nicole Kidman from, what was that Irish immigrant movie, Home and Away or Homebound or something? Yeah,
I haven't seen it.
She's a little Lucky Charms. what she's doing there. Yeah. What else? So there's a couple other things I don't understand. Do you know why the judge got cold feet for collaborating with the defense attorney, like around the third act of the film. Like he started calling strikes and balls fairly, but it looked like against his better judgment. Like I could have sworn that I missed a scene of like Paul Newman, like dropping evidence that he like, look, here's, I got a check stub. Are you taking payment from fucking the Roman Catholic Church or whatever? Did I miss something or
I don't think
he just,
so.
Did he get to be too much for the judge, even to stomach the evidence that he was seeing?
It might have been. And there is that scene early on where Frank threatens to bring it to the, you know, the association, the board, whatever, of lawyers there and get a mistrial. And maybe that put him on his back foot a little bit. He's still a dick through a lot of it, though. And
for sure.
I don't think that was the totality of it, but you're right. It feels like there is something missing there. And as well, it feels like there's something missing when Laura and Mickey have this conversation about Frank. They're sitting in the bar and they're talking like they're old friends here. They're talking like they haven't just met that moment.
Because this thing takes place in the span of a week, right?
Yeah. The trial, I think, was 10 days out when the movie starts. And then over the course of those 10 days,
5 days, it gets advanced 5 days and the judge does not grant a stay or a delay, rather.
Yeah, less than a week. And she's just talking to him like, we clearly have a relationship here when they never did in the movie. So I don't know. And now it kind of fixes a little bit of that when you find out she's a spy and she would have a lot of incentive to come talk to his best friend.
Yeah, be talkative over drinks and stuff. Yeah. But also, like, the fact that she worked her way into that much confidence. I mean, they do kind of establish the fact that that's kind of what he does. Like, he looks for a barfly to take home, and they know where he... Because they know that. That's, I also thought it was good, is, like, to show the... It's great because it showed the core competency of the defense staff when they're like, oh, this is the lawyer, and here's all we know about him. He's this and that and that, which kind of is our first introduction to Frank. But it also, you know, tells us a lot. It tells us a lot about Frank. It also shows their competence. But like, I think they would know what bar he frequents because he always goes to the same damn one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, hey, if we get a kind of like a lady like this to sit in the bar that she can probably get in really easy. And there's a lot of this movie, like, I feel like it doesn't hold your hand, which I like. Yeah. But also maybe also the film, because here's another example. That nurse that was refusing to go on the record, and it was protecting the other nurse, Casey, I forget what her name is.
Yeah, the admitting nurse.
The admitting nurse. Did you have in mind that, like, were they implying that there was a lesbian relationship there?
No, I wasn't getting that.
Because, like, sometimes in these older movies, the way they talk about this stuff is so coded and veiled that, like, a lot of times, like... I don't know what's going on because, like, I'm used to people just openly stating things, but because he says something like, you know, I went to visit her and I also know why you're shielding her. And like this nurse kind of like gets a shocked and offended look on her face and starts clamming up. And I'm like, what the fuck are they talking about? Like, but maybe it's just, I know why you're defending her because she got railroaded by these doctors and like, you know, she did it to save her job, but obviously she's not working there anymore. So she's like, she's been punished enough. Maybe it's just that. But the way it was such a strong accusation and such a strong reaction, I'm like, what the fuck is going on here?
I think the reaction was because, you know, someone who's changed their entire life to avoid that, like she's gone to the trouble of hiding her location, right? Doesn't tell anyone where she is so that she won't be asked questions and harassed, would actually just talk to a lawyer. Even before she talked to the nurse who was helping her, defending her, is like kind of a slap in the face to that nurse, right? I think that's why it was so shocking. I didn't get anything about like some kind of illicit relationship.
I thought a lot of the courtroom stuff was fairly well worn by today's standards. There's one thing I really liked, which is the inversion of Paul Newman steps in. Like, you know, one of the classic things you've heard if you watch any kind of courtroom dramas at all is like, you never want to ask a question on cross-examination that you don't know the answer to.
Yeah.
Because you're going to be shocked and flustered and it's likely information that you don't want to, that you don't want the jury to know about. And Paul Newman steps into that in the first place where he's like thought and he's talking about the anesthesiologist. He thought he had him dead to rights and started asking like innocent questions out of his own curiosity. And oh, it turns out, you know, this lady was anemic and she's low oxygen anyway. So it doesn't take 8 to 9 minutes for her brain to die. It just takes 2 to 3 minutes. And that's why it's not blah, blah, blah. Then you see the defense attorney make the exact same mistake the next act, where he's got this lady, and like I thought it was cool, the inversion, but also like this guy was so cool and professional and good that it almost strained my belief that he would walk into this. Like there was so many flashing red because he asked like 3 open-ended questions that he did not know the answer to, and every single answer was worse. And like for him not to like, okay, let's just stop and let's stop it there. But I don't know. Maybe he had confidence that he was going to get it thrown out. I guess that's the other thing is like, did the judge have a change of heart? Or because Paul Newman says when he's in his chambers, like, you know, going at it with him, said, I know about you. You were never much of a lawyer. Like you were not very good at the law. And like maybe that hesitancy is when they're asking evidentiary rules and people are citing different cases and this guy's like, fuck, I don't know. Like, I don't want to get disbarred for your dumb ass. But on the other, so maybe he's just uncomfortable with like that he's actually having to be a judge, and he couldn't quite do it. He's more of a toady and a lackey than he is an actual justice.
Yeah, it could be. I will say I have the least read of any character on that judge. Like, he's a bit of an enigma to me. I think the reason that the defense attorney gets flustered in that moment is because he's so used to being in control of the situation, right? He's got his team of 20 legal experts, and he's got his spies, and he's got his news outlets, and he controls everything in these cases. Mm-hmm. So when something comes up that he doesn't control, you know, he gets a little flustered there. I could see why that would be sort of a betrayal of like a character who should have so much experience in these situations, but
yeah. Because, man, they built him up to be this formidable thing. Like, I really love that scene where he's prepping the anesthesiologist for testimony. And he's just, like, being rude. Like, you know, no one in 20 years has talked down to this anesthesiologist and this defense attorney. He's like, no, stop with the bullshit. Short, direct answers. When he gets what he wants, he, like, pats him on the cheek patronizingly. And, like, that's better. And... you know, all but slaps him in the face and like, you know, in coaching this guy. But I really liked all that prep work because they like, again, the guy is a tactical genius. When this one guy barely contained glee, he's like, oh, he's got a expert witness who's kind of like shaking on his credentials. And best of all, he's black. And the guy like goes on his tirade about like, well, look, what we're not going to do is we're not going to make this about his blackness, and we're going to treat him like the same as anybody else. And we're going to just talk about his credentials and stuff. And he kind of trails off. He's like, all the same, why don't we retain a black attorney to sit on our side of the table, too? Just like,
I mean, that's shitty. Also, I don't believe that any of these fuckers know a black attorney in 1981 or whatever
Boston?
It is.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, a black attorney in Boston with the crowd I see in that fucking defense room. Yeah, I seriously doubt that any of them know anybody who's not 100% Irish Catholic.
Like, if they do, they play for the Celtics. That's what.
Sure, right. I like those juxtapositions, though. They do several times in the movie because they also have Mickey sort of doing the same thing with their star witness, right? The mm-hmm. is Dr. Thompson, the black doctor. He's kind of running him through those paces as well. But it feels more like discovery for them, like they're trying to understand what he's going to tell them as opposed to tailoring coaching what he says to the case. Yeah, they're just not as good at it as a defense team.
I have a random observation. I've never seen a person do this. I'm going to coin it turkey necking.
I know what you're talking about.
Paul Newman turkey necks a beer can.
He does. He just kind of tucks it, sticks his neck out, it under.
I've never seen a guy like do that. It's like it feels like it enveloped it like a koozie.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I could pull it off the beard. It might make it too slippery. But yeah, he just kind of like a pelican, like a reverse pelican. Mm-hmm. He reverse pelicans the beer or turkey necks it. that's worth the price of admission. It's like when you see Will Riker mount a chair for the first time, like that's so next level. Like I'm trying to juggle beer cans, and I got a third appendage that I didn't even know could hold a beer can. Good Lord. I learned so much from this man. That's what you learn from an alcoholic, out of turkey neck and beer.
It's true. I got some random observations. How about those camo seats in the airplane? Did you take a look at that airplane interior, man? Holy shit. Like you get kind of the textured stuff. You know how the walls of an airplane are, right? They'll have like a texture, but it'll be like, they'll also have a pattern, and it'll be like, I don't know, diamonds or something. It's very subtle. It's very tasteful. Not in 1981, man. In 1981, they had what basically looked like, I don't know, plaster walls smeared with the dirt of 100,000 disgusting children all putting their hands on the walls. The seats are fucking just straight up camouflage seats. I don't know what's happening.
Were they everything stained with nicotine? You know, this is the era where people smoked heavily on airplanes. So just right. Like, you know,
it was horrifying.
That stuff can get everywhere and stain. I didn't see that. I didn't see the 1980s airline decor.
It's bad. And I flew in the 80s and I don't remember it looking like that.
See, I did not. I think the first time I ever took a commercial flight was 96.
Wow.
Yeah.
Huh. Must have been. Did you take it on your own? Like after you got out of the house?
Yep. I was like 19. Okay. Like, that's when I flew to Hawaii. I flew myself on a FedEx plane. Wow. The LA to Honolulu was on a Delta jumbo.
That's wild, because the first place I flew to was Hawaii as well. But I was young. I was very young. We lived in California, so.
No, my parents are dirt poor. We didn't do much. Like, the only travel we did is we drove down every summer to my uncle's dairy farm in Mobile, Alabama.
Nice.
We spent half the week on their fucking farm, and then Dad would splurge for a three-day weekend at the Gulf Shores, Alabama, so we could get some ocean time in. Okay. Didn't do a lot of travel as a kid.
Any other observations? I have like one more.
Hit me with it.
The best line in the movie, in my opinion, is when the judge is like taking over the interrogation or the questioning of this witness, and Paul Newman says, "If you're gonna try my case for me, I wish you wouldn't lose it." Holy shit. That is a line.
Yeah. 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 I thought that's the thing. It's like, I was really surprised that he didn't get, like, because when the guy's like screaming, "I'm going to call the bailiff and have you this, that, and the other," is like, man, that's some pretty, like, even a corrupt, shitty judge. That's some strong talk that Newman was giving to him. But he doesn't.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that's the thing, is like Paul Newman, through the vast majority of this movie, just doesn't give a fuck. Not like, I mean, you can tell that he would feel really extra bad if he loses his case for his clients. Mm-hmm. But like, I saw how he was in the beginning of this movie. You know, he'd just become a bigger wreck of a human being, but it's not like,
yeah,
you know,
three eggs in the beer every morning instead of two.
Right. Yeah. It's a three egg.
The number three egg days
he would go up.
Yeah. He'd be cracking a whole dozen in there pretty soon. One other question I have for you. So he's wearing, this is a nice touch, I think, probably from Newman. He's wearing his class ring. Like the entire movie. I don't know if you saw that, but it sort of makes me think that he is, I don't know, trying to sort of, I don't know, has some nostalgia for that old life that he had, right? Like I get the impression that like this ring is probably from a prestigious, maybe Ivy League school.
He went to Harvard, I think they said. He was in the Harvard Law Review. Yeah, I think so.
That makes a ton of sense then. And, you know, he's sort of still living as if those glory days, as if he remembers them fondly, even though he's so far from them, both time-wise and also stature-wise.
Yeah, I also wondered if he, it was also a nod to his wife leaving him, that like, you know, he'd worn her wedding ring for a long time. He's got the dent on his finger and you know, he takes off his wedding ring. He puts a class ring on just to kind of have something to wear in its place.
Could be.
But also, yeah, your interpretation is really good, too. Like he's trying to just relive the glory years.
There's one other moment that I enjoyed when he goes to the archdiocese and Well, I can't remember exactly when it happens. There's a scene where he gets very excited about something, and it's pretty early on in the movie. And he goes out like into the parking lot. Oh, it's after he meets with that doctor who eventually goes off to the Caribbean. He goes in the parking garage. Yeah. And when he steps away from that conversation, he's so excited about it that he grabs his crotch, he jumps in the air, and he shouts, "Woohoo!" That's just
gives a good whoopee. I mean, that's how devastating this guy's going to be to the case, and how devastating it was to lose him, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I just found that hilarious.
Yeah, this guy's talking big game. Talking big game about how he's sick of these guys, and I want to take him there, or a bunch of blah blah blah, and then got to go on vacation. Oh, you know what?
Yeah,
I actually maybe it is that like as the trial got moved up, so maybe there wasn't any corruption at all. It's just that like these guys knew his schedule, and they know that like his housekeeper says, "Oh yeah, he doesn't have a phone down in his island getaway." Maybe they just they leaned on the judge to move up the trial so that it would coincide during his vacation, and it fuck him out of it. But I don't know. Maybe it doesn't,
because he arranged to meet that guy in the lockers at the hospital the night after, or that night, and the guy just didn't show up. So.
Yeah, you're right. Because I mean, obviously these people do dirty shit, and they pay people off, and they make people disappear and stuff like that.
Yeah.
All right, that's going to do it for our coverage of The Verdict. The Verdict is in. This is a pretty good movie. 4 stars from Ebert. It was nominated for 5 Academy Awards. Didn't win any, but it's very highly regarded. I, as I mentioned, it's top 10 in the AFI, like court dramas. I think it's number 4. And it's a really good...
successful as well.
Financially budget. Successful. This is also kind of a landmark in Newman's career, because I kept on seeing in contemporary reviews, this is like the first kind of snot, super hot hunk bursting with young energy role. This is like as a transition to old man Newman roles.
Yeah, I went through a Newman phase a little bit for a while, watching like some of his older stuff, like Slapshot and Butch Cassidy, that stuff. Mm-hmm. And you always get the flavor like, yeah, he's this kind of guy. He's a leading man, whatever. And then this movie came on my radar, and I was like, oh, that's different. That is very different.
Do you think the new Top Gun will be Tom Cruise's gateway into old man movies?
Gateway to being old?
We both remarked that, like, finally, the Scientology powers are waning, and he's a little bit showing his age in this trailer, at least.
Yeah.
A little, like, I don't think you can call, he's no longer believably portraying early 30s. But I don't know, like maybe they're actually letting him look a little old, because he's supposed to be old Maverick, and he'll be back to 30-year-old Ethan Hunt in the next Mission Impossible. But we'll see. This was his gatehood to old man movies.
It was his
transition.
And I like him as old man. I like him as old man as much as I like him as young stud Paul Newman.
He's got a lot of good rascal old man stuff ahead of him. In this movie. So hope you guys enjoyed it. We'll be back with another prestigious movie next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.